Hello and welcome to the Monocle Culture Show. I'm Tom Edwards. On the programme today, we're turning to the small screen for a new animated series from Matt Groening called Disenchantment. Groening is, of course, best known as the creator of one of the most famous animated families, The Simpsons, and his sci-fi hit Futurama. This new series, which has been made for Netflix, tackles a new time period, taking us to the fictional world of Dreamland, where much medieval mayhem ensues. But can it be as successful as its predecessors? To find out, I'll be joined in the studio by the writer and critic Lucy Jones and TV editor for The Evening Standard and critic for London Live, Toby Earle. Disenchantment opens on the wedding day of its protagonist, Princess Bean. But it's not your usual fairy tale wedding. Bean's a rebellious alcoholic, hell-bent on not getting married to the prince her parents have planned for her. Along with her two new friends, a demon called Lucy and an elf named Elfo, they make their escape and the adventures begin.
Bean, you're out of control. I don't even know what to yell at you.
I'm not so bad.
Well, you did kill that one guy.
I'd be fine if someone could just slide my head up a bit.
Lucy and Toby, welcome to the programme. When does a new show by someone like Matt Groening, when that comes along, I guess it's going to excite people. Lucy, I'll start with you, and sort of irritate people. Almost, it's almost guaranteed to do that in equal measure, isn't it? He's sort of damned if he doesn't, damned if he doesn't. Do you think he was aware that he was probably going to disappoint somebody?
He must have been. I mean, his legacy is kind of assured, isn't it? And I mean, doing a hat trick with Simpsons, Futurama and Disenchantment being all brilliant is kind of too good to be true, maybe. A little bit. I can't imagine what it must be like to be Matt Groening and, you know, have had these incredible successes and then know that, you know, people are going to want to kind of tear it down. And I think that's kind of reflected maybe in some of the quality of this show. It feels a little bit tired and lazy to me.
Well, we'll come on to that in a second. But Toby, just to that point, it is interesting, because I guess if we go back to what, the late 90s, I suppose, when Futurama came around, he's kind of been through this once already. And there were a lot of people really, really negative about that. And its sort of status has been assured. And it was outwardly incredibly successful. It ran for something like eight years, something like that. And yet it's always viewed, even Futurama is viewed as a sort of the, to some degree, as a poor relation to The Simpsons. And yet another creator who'd made Futurama would be lauded as, you know, what, potentially one of the greats.
Yeah, completely. When it came along, the comparisons were immediately drawn with The Simpsons, unavoidably, simply because, oh, it's Matt Groening. Oh, look, the well, of course the animation's going to look, because it's Matt Groening doing the animation. I agree. If someone else had come along with Futurama, people would have said, this is brilliant, this is a game changer. There might have been issues of people might have said, well, it feels very similar to other animations we've seen before, but they would sort of lauded its idea, its take on the future, how Fry, as the fish out of water, deals with the future around it, the relationships that are drawn in there. But it is Groening, and yes, eventually Futurama bedded in, and people sort of stopped talking about it. It did have a run. It was cancelled once, then brought back. Won 6 Emmys. Simpsons has won something like 31, I think. So it's always going to be the distant cousin. But here, I think what you've touched upon here is the kind of main point, and sort of also sort of Lucy's point too, is that disappointment is guaranteed. It is absolutely assured, no matter what happens. Now, whatever he does, people are going to say it's not good enough.
He can't win.
He cannot. He absolutely cannot win. And The Simpsons, let's be quite honest. I mean, let's be absolutely honest here. The Simpsons has not been good, and it's incredible you can say this. The Simpsons has not been good for 20 years. Like, it is still funny at times, but in terms of the golden era, that has long since passed. Futurama tried, you know, had to hit the ground running. It took a while for it to really take off. I think it took off in its later stages. You look back on the first couple of series now, I think, with some affection, some enjoyment. But yeah, Disenchantment comes along, and people just think, well, I mean, it's not The Simpsons or as good as, well, no, not as good as 1993 Simpsons, maybe.
And it is interesting, I suppose, if you look at it in the round, these with these three different tranches. Lucy, obviously, we've looked at the Futurama, which looked at the future. The Simpsons was very much now and has had to kind of continue to be now for a quarter of a century or so, which is a weird one of itself. Mm. This looks to the past. And what struck me as interesting about that was he's dabbled with this before, and the writers team. If you think on The Simpsons, there were quite a few medieval parodies. Mm. He obviously got a certain sort of interest in that, he and the team. It was an obvious place to go, though, wasn't it? Even if he doesn't quite pull it off. Does that make sense that he looked to the sort of medieval realm and the sort of fairy tale thing to pastiche a little?
Well, I guess it's the only way, the only other kind of direction to look. It's like, you know, present, future, past. And I think, you know, it's a really kind of fruitful period and time to mine. I think he described it as the offspring of Simpsons and Game of Thrones. It's kind of like a, you know, Matt Groening Westeros. And, yeah, it makes sense. It's kind of a fertile ground for kind of the fantastical, the surreal, the absurd, the funny. I mean, the success of Game of Thrones suggests that people are kind of into that kind of period and looking back. And, yeah, there's a lot of room for kind of jokes and characters. Whether it works or not, I'm sure we will go on to.
Well, exactly. And let's talk about that a bit. I wonder whether the fact that you can kind of watch it all, because it's inescapable, the fact that it's on Netflix is a big deal. You can obviously watch more of it in one go. I think we've got half the episodes. Is that
already?
They're all there already.
All 10 were up on Friday.
There were 20. Yeah, there were 20.
So there are more to come.
There are more to come. But yeah, sorry to interrupt you there. So, but all 10 are up. Sorry, Lisa. Yeah.
But does that change, I guess, as a critic, does that change? It's different than, I know you'd always get previews and stuff, but knowing that everyone can watch it all in one go, I don't know, does that change the dynamic in any way, or is that not really relevant?
I think I watched all of them in kind of 3 days. I watched kind of a third each day, and it does that thing on Netflix, you know, how it runs on immediately, so even if you're thinking, oh, I'm only going to watch one and then I'll go do something else, it starts and then you think, oh, I'm sitting here, I'll just watch the next one anyway. It's kind of in control. Yes, there is a plot which kind of runs through, but each episode also kind of stands alone and has its own kind of plot within it, and then subplots too. So it's not the kind of show where you've got cliffhangers and you really want to keep watching and to find out what happens next, I don't think.
So in that sense, a bit different. Let's talk a bit more about it then. Toby, what of the world that's created? You mentioned already this idea of a signature style. It needs to be identifiably Matt Groening.
Yeah.
Does it look the part, at least, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. It's 2D, but then they have those kind of 3D swoops through the country, through the castle and whatnot. And so you kind of get that sense of depth which exists. It is a world which is fully realised. And I think when you're talking about the sort of the Game of Thrones meets Matt Groening, I mean, it's inescapable that there is a Tolkien-sized gap, like a gap as big as a dwarf's mine currently in the schedules as we wait for Game of Thrones to return in 2019. So the timing's really kind of fascinating, because they can grab that narrative, they can grab that sort of fantastical space and occupy it for this brief period of time before we come back to that. But the opportunity, as Lucy said, to expand this environment is enormous, because in the first series you have giants, you have dwarves, you have gnomes, you have elves, you have a griffin later on, you have at the very end something that looks very much like a ship crewed by the creatures from the island of Dr. Moreau. And so the really can play with the sword and sorcery genre, and it takes it on, and I think it really does fly in. I mean, you said there's no cliffhanger. There is literally a cliffhanger at the end of episode one.
That's true.
But it establishes it pretty rapidly. I think perhaps it does feel a little old-fashioned in some respects, because the hyper-density of some of the, again, golden era Simpsons pieces, it doesn't quite exist. There are lots of sight gags, don't get me wrong. There are a lot of great punchlines, and I'm pretty pro it, but it doesn't have that kind of layer upon layer upon layer at the start. But again, if you flew into that, I think at the very beginning, people might well be put off by the sheer density of something like that. I think you've got to get to know these individuals first before you can then start dropping in a greater level of gag and of density of joke.
And it's interesting to look at some of his collaborators. Groening has used a number of the voice actors who'll be familiar through, well, all of the season, particularly from Futurama. But there's it seems a kind of uptick, Lucy, in terms of British talent involved,
it's very
which is obviously good on this side of the pond. We're sort of proud to see some of these people who you always wonder if they're, you know, a sort of Noel Fielding. Does the comedy travel? Well, it seems it certainly travelled to Matt Groening. He's a huge fan. He's been very informed by the sort of British comedy sensibility through his whole career. There's loads of them. That's good to see, isn't it?
It is. And I think a couple of them are written by Richard Fulcher, who played Bob Fossil in Mighty Boosh, which I think we go on to talk about later. And I don't know whether Matt Groening's kind of friends with Rich Fulcher, but he's got a lot of credits going through the episodes. You've got Matt Berry, who just steals the scene and steals the episode whenever he's on for me. And then actually my favourite character comes a bit later, and that's the stepmother of Bean, voiced by Sharon Horgan, who actually sounds like Liz Hurley, but then she's on, like, at times she kind of will sound like herself, and she's absolutely brilliant in it. And for me, that was a real kind of uplift of quality in the show. And then, you've got Noel Fielding playing the executioner Stan in episode 5, which is really funny. So, it's quite sweet and nice to hear those British voices. You don't really hear them in American comedy that much.
And I wonder, are they a bit underused? Because I've read a couple of pieces of criticism suggesting Matt Berry's characters, for example, are exactly as he described, scene stealing, and maybe could be more prominent. But I guess maybe that's an option that's there. As it kind of grows and develops.
Again, this comes back to character and use of character and how that develops over a period of time. Let's wheel back to the very beginning of The Simpsons. The central character of The Simpsons was Bart Simpson. It was Bart Simpson who was the main character. That was what it was all about. It was all about Bart, the rebellious kid mucking around. Now, it, of course, now is Homer. And that didn't happen until, it was the episode Homer Goes to College. And when Homer, as we know him now, this kind of absolute moron, who's like a
beautiful moron.
I mean, he is incredible. I mean, was that series 3, episode 5, something like that? I've got that wrong, and I'm gonna sound terrible. But it took ages for that character to establish itself and to find who that person was. Now, with Prince Merkham and Matt Berry, Lucy's absolutely right. Matt Berry's tongue all but carves that character on screen. It is brilliant, and you definitely want more of him. Sharon Horgan, well, obviously, I think we're going to have loads of her in series 2. But again, I think there's that kind of relation. There is that relationship between the voice artists, the writers, the animators, as they all work out who works best, who can expand the character the most, which direction can they go with this person. And I think at the very beginning, you think, okay, Bean's clearly the centre, but there's opportunity for things to change. I don't think she'll necessarily be displaced, but there is definitely room for these other characters to evolve.
Maneuver around the margins. Lisa, you started off by saying you weren't quite sold. And I wonder whether there's a little bit too much flab. Some of the episodes run longer than the sort of very tight 22 minutes cable TV. Now, obviously, this is one of the things that Netflix affords creatives, which they like. But is that a good thing? Do you think maybe there's a little bit of, I don't know, sort of an edit that maybe
it
was needed?
I think it definitely could have been improved with tighter editing. The pilot's 35 minutes, which I think is probably okay to kind of set it up. But then the ensuing episodes are all about 28, 29. I personally think they could have been kind of 22, 23. Mm. Like, there's a lot of moments and jokes and kind of scene set up, which I thought, I don't really get what's going on here. It's not funny. It's kind of weird. And it kind of cannibalises the good jokes as well, when you're kind of getting a bit bored and a bit kind of restless. And, I mean, Simpsons were like 20 minutes, weren't they?
22. Yeah.
22 minutes. Oh, that, for me, seems like the perfect kind of chunk of time. And maybe they will, in the second kind of tranche, the second 10 episodes, be shorter. I don't know. I think also the length of episode, it really depends on how compelling the characters are. And for me, Bean, for example, is a little bit of a caricature at the moment. She's kind of like this ladette person who seems to kind of feed into an idea of like a feminist princess, but it's a little bit kind of cliched for me and schlocky. But maybe as time goes by, and certainly I grew to really like watching Elfo and some other characters, maybe the length of the episodes won't mind as the world gets more realised and the jokes land a bit less flat.
Mm. And in terms of that thing which you've both spoken about, this idea of the layering on of complexity, of ambition, I'm always put in mind in Futurama, and I think, Toby, you mentioned earlier that it took a couple of seasons to get going. There was an episode, I think, in like the third season where Bender is sent out into space and a community springs up on his body, and it asks all these really huge questions about the nature of existence and being God, which I thought was amazing that you could ask essentially philosophical questions in a cartoon. Presumably, Groening and his team will be given the time. They'll have the time. That's the way Netflix works, to do that, even if it takes a couple of seasons. Or is there a risk that if it falls a bit flat critically...
I mean,
I don't know.
It's a great. I mean, it's a really great question. Yes, you would think if Netflix have splashed for a name like Matt Groening, they have gone for Matt Groening. Whether or not there were, you know, behind closed doors, there were, you know, Fox was keen for this, whatever. But Netflix have grabbed one of the most important comic voices of late 20th century television. They've grabbed him. You would like to think, understand that it takes time for shows to evolve, particularly maybe an animated show, and particularly when it's Matt Groening. You think, let's give him time. Now, yes, we have these we have the second set of 10 episodes to come. Will they drop him? I would be very, very surprised if they dropped him after the second set of 10 and said, well, that's it, we tried.
Even if the reviews continue to be so lukewarm.
I mean, I think lukewarm is, again, we'll go back to how we started, disappointed from the off, right? The people were going to be disappointed from the off. There are times I wonder what is exactly what people want, like in terms of kind of characters immediately hitting the mark. That is so tough. And I know it can be done. I think animation, is it harder than real life, sort of real life comedy? I don't know, maybe, because you can do anything, go anywhere. Now, if you don't have that straight away from the off, people are automatically writing you off. I think there's room and time for it to grow. And again, Netflix is all about bringing in the very top tier of talent. They want to be this hub of creative excellence and to have these programs that people want to see. Now, again, you bring Matt Groening aboard with his track record, his team's track record, the voice cast, some are the same, some new voices. Again, it would seem like an awfully big opportunity missed if they were to just say after 20 episodes, which isn't even a full run sometimes of like a series of The Simpsons, they went, nah, we're done.
And I guess they can afford to be more speculative. They can afford to take their time. Where do you think, Lucy, we are in terms of the status of animation currently? Because, and we're going to talk a bit more about some other Netflix offers in just a second, but Netflix, obviously, a new platform which is driving, and they seem very happy to finance some pretty out there animation. Is it in a good place at the moment?
Well, I think, I mean, when I started sat down to watch this, the thing that I was thinking is this going to be like as good as BoJack Horseman? I mean, I think that's probably the like most critically and commercially successful animation in the last 5-10 years or so.
Probably. Well, Rick and Morty was the one, but certainly on Netflix, I think you're right. BoJack is the one that's nabbed the headlines.
Yeah. But I think, I mean, going back to what you were saying about like life's big questions and the philosophical angle, if a animation doesn't kind of ask those questions or make you laugh, which is what BoJack Horseman did, I'm not sure if it has much kind of longevity.
BoJack Horseman, I mean, outwardly ridiculous, farcical setup, but it's quite dark. And again, it gets into these areas about depression, and it's quite compelling. There's a sort of drama and a darkness to it. Are there any little seams of that you could see in Disenchantment that could sort of come through with a bit stronger writing, perhaps?
Definitely. And I think later, as the characters kind of unfurl, you get a lot more pathos around, for example, Bean's relationship with her father and her stepmother, and a kind of deeper feeling around that relationship. She reveals that she put a dead owl in the wedding cake of her father and stepmother. And you get kind of a sense of, like, you know, why she drinks so much. And, you know, she's basically an alcoholic, and what kind of feeling she's trying to drink away.
When you're asking about the big existential questions, like, has any cartoon ever asked an existential question better than Wile E. Coyote's pursuit of Roadrunner? Because that in itself is probably the greatest existential question ever posed by a cartoon every single time. There's nothing else to it. It is, this is what I want. How do I get it? Mm-hmm. Can I get it? And the disappointment after disappointment, and the futility of the chase. And also at the end of it, what would he do? What would happen? What would happen to that relationship? What would happen to his life if he was to grab Roadrunner? Like, there, I mean, essentially, everything else is building up from that, right? Just that pursuit of futility in some ways.
You could write a thesis on that. That's a great thought.
What are we saying? Are we saying that Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote have answered all the big questions?
I think that's what we are saying. I'm more than happy with that. I love the idea of that being the sort of philosophical high watermark in terms of animation. What's Acme Products then? Is that like the Roman Catholic Church or something in that analogy?
I suppose now you might say that's something maybe like the internet, which can ostensibly give you everything but deliver nothing.
See, who says we shy away from the big questions here? Now, as regular listeners to this programme will know, we like to ask our guests to sort of detour off onto a topic or a theme that our main talking point prompts them to consider. And actually, Toby, you just mentioned this, so we'll come straight back to it. Rick and Morty, another animation beloved by many. I guess it's an obvious question of why this put you in mind of that, but what does your knowledge and, I think, enthusiasm for Rick and Morty tell you about Disenchantment? How does that frame your vantage point on the new series?
Right, if I was going to take an angle on this, which I'm about to do, it would be the angle that I really hope that the fans of Disenchantment don't end up like some of the fans of Rick and Morty, because it became this pop culture phenomenon, this comedy created by Dan Harmon and Justin Roiland. Dan Harmon, probably perhaps best known for Community, the brilliant ensemble comedy, which you will probably say now kind of launched Donald Glover into our sort of consciousness, maybe along with Alison Brie, and she did Mad Men. But so this comedy where you have this alcoholic, misanthropic grandfather taking his grandson on rides through space and time, and it's very, we'll go back to the density of jokes, a lot in there. It's actually influenced by British sci-fi quite heavily. Doctor Who is a huge reference point for that. But what has grown up around it in some parts of the fandom is something quite dreadful in terms of how female writers on the show have been targeted, people complaining about the quality of the season and it being blamed on the women in the writers' room, because it went to address the gender imbalance in the writing room. It hired female writers. People then started blaming these female writers for the quality of the shows, which they perceived to be less good, less funny than previous episodes that were written by men, because men can do comedy. And then it kind of then spiraled. That was bad enough, them being identified online and targeted. But then there was this absolutely insane hysteria around the release of a Szechuan sauce that was part of a storyline, that was a limited edition sauce that was released by McDonald's back in the 90s, I think, 98. They did this stunt where they had this stunt where it was released, and there were, I mean, nigh on riots. Police were called, people buying it, selling it on eBay for hundreds of dollars. I think I read one guy drove from Canada to get some, couldn't get any. What is wrong with people? What is wrong with people? And that is a very specific aspect of a group of fans of Rick and Morty. I would very much like Disenchantment to not have that kind of level of hysteria, of mania. I would like it to be enjoyed by people. If people don't like it, fair enough, right? That's fine. That's not for you. That's cool. But I think you can, and we kind of get back to the sort of like guarantee to disappoint scenario, is that people think that something should be a certain way, and if it's not a certain way, then they have let them down personally, and their vengeance should somehow be theirs. And I think that happens a lot with certain pop culture sort of products at the moment. You can talk about The Last Jedi, for example, how people have reacted to that. I would very much like it not to go that way.
But does that tell us more about the perils of the sort of bottom half of the internet? Or do you think there is something peculiar about that demographic, which is in animation fandom land, where there is a propensity to, I don't know, be more zealous one way or the other? What I don't know. Is it a particular quality about animated programming that seems to drive that kind of? I mean, it's an obsessive quality,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, because I think maybe perhaps a lot of them have draw in so many influences that, and they have these running jokes, they have these in gags, they have the site, but they draw in so many influences that then people can kind of become hyper obsessed with every single aspect of it. And certainly this notion of quality, and talking about Rick and Morty, like somehow a woman's name in front of an episode therefore makes it less relevant, less worthy than when it has a man's name in front. I mean, that is absolutely ridiculous, and I wouldn't want to say that every single animation fan is like that, because of course they are not. I think Rick and Morty has attracted a certain group of people, it would appear, that I can't remember ever really being associated with another animation. I know Futurama fans were very passionate, and when they got it back there was an online protest and whatnot, but I can't remember anything like this.
And intriguing and certainly unwelcome social phenomenon, but very interesting. And it is intriguing how that informs perhaps aspects of the critical backdrop. Let's pick up on another thing which we've already mentioned, Lucy, for your choice. We talked about Noel Fielding. Mm. I don't know, a star who I wondered whether would have transatlantic appeal, just because it's his comedic bent is so interesting and nuanced. And you want to talk about, well, a programme that showcases that like no other, of course, Mighty Boosh.
Quite a thumb you got on you there. There's a story behind there, isn't it?
You want to know about my thumb, do you, boy? Intrigue you, does it, boy? My thumb? Let me tell you about it. I come from a long line of hitchhikers. All with bleeding massive thumbs.
It wasn't just Noel Fielding and Matt Berry and finding out that Richard Fulcher, Bob Fossil and Boosh were involved in and star in Disenchantment. It's also the kind of tone of it. So there's a lot of kind of absurdist, surrealist, almost kind of Dada-esque moments in Disenchantment, kind of non sequiturs and kind of random ways people die in bizarre, kind of absurdist characters, like the stepmother of Bean, for example, is some kind of strange reptile and she kind of moves around in this bizarre way. And that for me was the moments in Disenchantment that I really loved and kind of reminded me of Mighty Boosh. And then I was thinking, okay, is there something, because I didn't really particularly enjoy Disenchantment, I love Mighty Boosh. I was thinking, is there something about kind of animated versus real comedy going on here? And then I was wondering whether, what is surreal comedy kind of for? And thinking about the kind of wider political context at the moment. And, you know, the news is not a lot of fun. A lot of people feel very unstable and life feels a bit more uncertain than it did kind of 5-10 years ago. And there's not a lot of jokes you can have with kind of the news or current affairs. In Disenchantment, they certainly try and bring in some modern day comedy. There's one joke, the giant says, "I'm not a monster, I've got thoughts and feelings, I'm a grad student." you know, so there is kind of a sense of trying to bring in kind of modern day issues and there's like a joke about kind of gender neutral crew and... But there's not a lot that you can kind of mine of like modern life at the moment for comedy, I think. I mean, South Park did quite well in the last series, but that was, I feel, before things started to get really awful, awful in the news. And I was thinking, is there something about Disenchantment coming out now and the need that we have for fantasy and turning off from the news, but thinking about the absurd and the surreal? I was looking at Boosh and when it came out, which was kind of the Bush years. And then if you look back to the kind of genesis and beginning of surrealist comedy, it's World War One. And, you know, hopefully we're not going into a world war, but, you know, I think there's something about surreal comedy which is just, you know, a good escape and maybe quite kind of timely now. I mean, I'm sure Matt Groening was thinking about Disenchantment kind of before Trump was elected and then before things started to get a bit uncertain. But I think that there's something kind of there maybe about Boosh and about Disenchantment, that it fulfills a need in the viewer to kind of go to a different place, but to have life kind of upended and made to look absurd, to make us feel maybe less worried.
Lucy, just one final thought. You mentioned your reservations. Have you seen enough, though, that you'll at least be back for the next 10, I don't know, a season two? You talked about your enthusiasm for Matt Groening broadly. Enough to keep you on board, or does it need to improve and improve fast?
I think that the last few episodes, there's a plot which I really enjoyed it, actually. I think it did pick up towards the end. I'd probably check in on the next 10 episodes, maybe the first one or two. I just didn't laugh that much. I maybe laughed twice in 10 episodes. And I am a bit of a Scrooge McDuck when it comes to comedy. But, you know, it's just not enough for me. So maybe I'll check in. But I was a little disenchanted.
See, that's good. That's
and you said
good.
You don't know animation. There you are, dropping in Scrooge McDuck references.
Very good. You see, it all comes together in the end. Thanks to you both for being with us. That brings us to the end of today's programme. Disenchantment is available to watch on Netflix right now. Thanks to Lucy Jones and Toby Earle, and to our producer, Holly Fisher. Robert Bound will be back next Monday to look ahead to what's coming up in books, music and film throughout the autumn season, so do be sure to join him then. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards, that is all. Thanks for listening.